When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The Andy J Podcast. The Andy J Podcast. The Andy J Podcast.
Hey, welcome to a bonus episode of the Andy J Podcast. How you doing? Hope your week's going really well. Hope you enjoyed James Martin earlier this week. If you're listening because you love celebrity chefs, you won't be disappointed because this one is with a maestro, John Burton Race. And if you're just listening for a bit of celebrity chat, I'll tell you what, he really brings his A game. It was a lovely conversation. So a nice quick half hour with a man who has so many Michelin stars to his name and was really, really great company. Enjoy.
The Andy J Podcast.
I am so pleased to welcome my next guest. Wow. Okay, he's a chef, a restaurateur, a consultant, an author, a media personality. He literally juggles Michelin stars. It's the marvellous John Burton Race. How are you doing, John?
I'm doing really well. Thank you.
I like the idea, John, and I know that it's not necessarily a visual image that you have adopted yet, but I like the idea of you literally juggling with Michelin stars. Could you do that?
Possibly. I mean, I am getting a bit older, so maybe I'll need my glasses.
Totally random and bizarre question for you. Are they a physical thing? Are they something that you get to sort of, like an Oscar, where you get to have a trophy, as it were, or was it just a...
No, not really. I mean, you get a mention in the guidebook, obviously, and if you're that sort of person, you can get hold of a plaque, which will tell people that you've got a Michelin star. But the people that follow the Michelin guide have usually got their book and know what's happening. And nowadays, of course, everything's on your mobile phone. So Yes. There's a Michelin app which you can look at, and they'll tell you all the changes, who's got what, and who's gone up, who's gone down, and who's gone out. So that's how that works, I think.
Have you ever been that guy that's got the plaque?
Definitely not, no.
Oh, I would need to do it, John. Got so many. You could have a huge, great hall.
I tell you what, when I was younger, I actually thought about it because it's nice to have the gongs and whistles and show off about it. I remember a long, long time ago, I won Chef of the Year, you know, the Katie Award.
Yeah.
And it's this beautiful bronze statue of this naked girl holding a scallop shell. And it really is quite prestigious. And because I think there would have been only about 10 chefs before me that had won it, I thought I used to display that all over the place and move it around and show off to the lads in the kitchen, most of which didn't know what I was doing or what I was talking about. So.
Where is it now?
It's in my study.
Good.
And I have to say, I had a glass dome built for her. And I broke it.
Oh, no.
And so it's there. And someone said to me, because it's bronze, don't ever polish it. And because she's naked, that'd be a bit weird anyway. So I'm not going to do that. But I did break the glass dome that I spent a fortune getting molded to, you know, to make it look more substantial. But anyway, there you go.
There we go. And you've never had the Brasso out. Fair enough.
No, I mean, definitely not.
Yeah, well, I'm glad it still has a place, though, and it's not just kind of hiding in the attic or something.
No, definitely. I mean, all those things are a great honour. You don't want to get flippant about it. If people think that you're that or you're this, it's great to have that sort of appreciation. And I don't think that changes, even though, you know, as you get on with your career. It's just that perhaps you're I wouldn't say you're not as hungry, but you settle down a little bit. But as you get older, you mellow and... You know, those things, as long as your customers are happy and as long as they keep coming back, that's the main thing because, of course, that's your bread and butter.
Yes, absolutely. And, of course, it's a very British thing, John, you know, that the sort of being humble kind of, oh, thank you so much. But, yeah, no, I won't brag about it.
Yeah, we have got that thing about Actually, that's really weird because I was talking to a friend of mine the other day about that, and we have got that thing about it's okay to be second,
okay.
which was never bred in me because I remember when I was a little boy and I used to have a pony and I used to go off to Gymkhana's, and my mother, every time I came second or third, my mother always used to say to me, "No one remembers you if you've come second." So you're never going to get a pat on the back from her. And I think she must have given me my original ambition, I think, to try and do better and more. But, I don't know.
Do you know, that's a really interesting insight, John. I'd love to talk to you about your childhood because, of course, we all know that with chefs, it is such a competitive world in which you live, and the hours that you have to put in, the dedication you have, there's no point in going in if you're not 100% dedicated, is it?
Well, yeah, no, that's true, but it's almost like any vocational job. One of my sisters is a doctor and she puts in some stupid hours,
right.
And the other one sort of teaches medicine now, but, and likewise, she works all the hours God sends. But being a chef is probably a vocational type of job. But the thing is, if you're consumed by it and if you love what you do, it isn't such a chore. You've got to remember, as a young bloke or a young girl, you know, you're gonna have to work all the weekends because that's when everyone's off. You're going to have to work the summer holidays and then, of course, Christmas. And it's a completely all-consuming type of career. And then that's before you talk about the pressure of a kitchen or the pressure of a business as you go up the ranks. But it's not as bad as it looks if you love it and you're prepared to surrender yourself to the job, you know.
Yes.
I think, especially in your early days, you become a who's driving what, you know. Is the job driving you or are you driving the job? And basically, the job is, if you want to be any good, you have to let it consume you, I think.
Yes, how do you, I mean, I've always wondered this about chefs, John. How do you have friends? Because you're just always, always, always in the kitchen.
Well, most chefs are a bit weird anyway and obnoxious. And so they haven't got a lot of friends. And as for close friends, not really. It's more like, because you are consumed about what you do and ambitious about what you do, and because you move all the time, it's always a good idea if you can, as a young apprentice, to work under a great chef with a, you know, for the experience. Maybe 1 year, move around the sections, 2 years at maximum, and then move. And then you might go abroad, and then you might go here, and you might go there. So you're a bit, it's a bit nomadic as well. So as far as that's concerned, it's not brilliant on any relationship, you know, girlfriend, boyfriend, wife, husband. It's not good. It really isn't. And it takes a special type of woman to put up with chefs, I think.
Yes. I've spoken to several chefs, many of whom have been married a few times. It's not sort of, I can't think of one.
I can't remember how many times I've been married, but I mean, yes, it is difficult. But the one thing I've always said to myself is that the job's been true to me. You know, I mean, I've probably given a lot to it, but it's given me a lot back, and I'm still learning all the time. And there's not many jobs that you can think, oh God, you're still ambitious, you're still trying to find out. I totally love it.
Yes, I think that is one of the things as well that is unique amongst wonderful leading chefs like yourself, is it is, you live it and breathe it all the time, don't
you? Yeah, absolutely right. And also, you know, it isn't until you're a little bit older that you develop your own sort of identifiable style. You know, it's a bit, I think when you start, it's all about trying to impress everybody, the general public probably, and you're trying to be clever for the sake of being clever. But as you go along in life, you know, it calms down, and you like anything else, when you get to a certain age, you know what you like, what you don't like, you know what you want to say on your plate. If you understand what I'm saying, and you develop your own identifiable style. I mean, someone asked me the other day, what's the difference between a cook and a chef? And I think you can learn how to cook. You can be a cook. You can learn. Technically, there's the science of food, the history of food, the do's and the don'ts. But it's not until later on, once you've got that behind you, that you actually become a chef, because you develop your own style. You know, if you were a painter and you had 10 or 12 paintings from 10 or 12 different artists on the wall, if you were a great art critic, you could tell which artist painted what. You know, if you say, look, all of you paint a chicken, all the chickens would be different, from the mad to the and insane to the sort of the set piece still life. And it's a bit like that when you're cooking. You know, you give 12 chefs in a room, all of some repute, a chicken to cook, every chicken will come out differently, you know, because they've got their own style of and their own approach to the dish. And I think that's what happens.
Yes, and like with artists, John, and each individual will have a preference. You know, it won't be that this tastes better than that. It's this tastes different to, and my palate loves this one, or I like looking at that piece.
Yeah, but even the best chefs can muck up. You know, sometimes good cooking is a question of seconds. You know, if you leave a souffle in an oven for, I don't know, 30 seconds, not enough. And it's horrible. It's not no longer Babers as you're supposed to serve it, so soft in the middle. It's just bloody undercooked, you know. But if you leave it 2 minutes more, it's a sponge cake. So, and I think, and especially not just desserts, but especially with fish cookery, you know, even the best chefs, because of pressure of the service and you're doing loads of different plates and at loads of different times, and you're trying to hit the pass at the right time so you get the guy on the garnishes to come together and meet you with the sauce. If anything falls down on the service, a plate can go out that's probably not as good as it could be. And that's the nature of the beast. It's the human element that is a bit dodgy, you know?
Yes, yes. What are you like in the kitchen, John? Are you aggressive? Are you one of these sort of famously angry spear throwers?
I get terribly in myself on service, and I go terribly quiet, and I'm concentrating to the maximum. And because of that, if something does go wrong, I sort of explode. But not probably now so much as I used to when I was younger. And you've just got to get it out. It's like that mad panic if you're in the theatre just before the curtain draws. You know, everyone's scrattling around and everyone's being terribly rude and loud and horrible. And then, curtain opens and off you go. Mm-hmm. And sometimes during a service, things can get terribly wrong, you know, and you haven't got time to discuss it. It's like, oh, I'm terribly sorry, you know, I should have cooked the carrots. Well, that's not bloody good enough. You know, every plate that goes out has got your name on it. So it's very difficult. I think, again, you learn that there is a tomorrow and there will be a sunrise, and you have to calm down. And as long as you endeavour to do your best and produce the best you possibly can, that's all you can expect, I think.
Do you still get nervous before a service?
I get... probably not nervous. I get excited. So I love it. I remember when I was younger, if we're like packed and we knew that there was going to be crazy bookings, I used to hold the kitchen back. In other words, the waiters would come in bringing checks, this table, that table, this table, that table, and I wouldn't let anyone start until it was total chaos. Because then off you go. And then they'd all look at you thinking, oh, why are they doing this? But I just think people do work much better under pressure.
Really?
And yeah, I really do. I think you get moments of genius if you're, your back's against the wall. If everything is all planned and everything's all nicey-nicey, the food's always nicey-nicey. You want something electric. You want something stunning. You want something inspirational. And it might only happen 2 or 3 services in your lifetime. It's when you're under pressure. That's what I think.
Oh, wow. So you're a pressure power player.
I just feel the more excitement you get out of the job, the better. That's all.
I love it. Wow, it's brilliant. John, let's talk about the early days. Born and raised in Singapore, which is, again, quite an unusual, given you are clearly a true Brit these days, it's quite an unusual start. So where did the love and passion for food come from?
Well, I think it did start in the Far East, because my father worked for the UN, and I suppose I used to, whilst I was very, very young, moved from place to place. So I lived in Malaya, Singapore, obviously, Bangkok. I went to the American school there when I was younger, and Indonesia, and one or two other places, which I can't remember. And the love of food. So we were fortunate enough to have a lot of people helping us being, because my father was terribly important, I thought. But so we always had a cook, and I always used to go in to the kitchen with a cook. And that's not me making those horrible noises, by the way. That's my dog snoring. And I suppose I've always been interested in food, and especially as a little boy, I always ate too much, you know, because I loved it. And I remember being in a hotel lobby once in Singapore. I think it was not a special place. I think it was called the Goodwood Park Hotel, and with my mother. And this massive fat guy with a huge white hat came in, and I thought, right, okay, who's he? I thought he was terribly impressive. And I said to my mother, what's that then? And she said to me, that's a chef. I said, I want to be a chef.
Wow.
And I think I was 9. And I've always, since then, really wanted to either do art or something arty. And it was a Victorian attitude of my parents, you know, no son of mine is doing art. What a waste of time. Oh, wow. You'll never get a job. And so this was the next best thing. And I think they were thinking, because I was really lazy at school, I think they were hoping that I sort of make my books back and knuckle under and get back to do something more academic. But that wasn't to be. And the more I got into it, you know, the lunatic of the job, travel, the excitement of different people and different food and, you know, the more I loved it. So that's how that started, I think.
It does sound like a really remarkable existence, John, I must say. You make it sound really
fun. You know, this job has taken me everywhere, you know. I mean, even coming out of lockdown, I know that at the end of December, I'll be in the Maldives at Suniva, sushi, cooking. And, you know, before lockdown, I was cooking in Vietnam. Unfortunately, that company has gone to the wind because it relied terribly on the tourist trade.
Right.
And there isn't any, and that's a shame. But, you know, I cooked in the Caribbean and the Maldives, Mauritius, and south of France. And I love the travel bit, you know. I absolutely love seeing different ingredients, going around different markets, learning about different produce. And adapting a product. I mean, if you go off to do something like, I'm going to be their guest chef over the Christmas period in the Maldives, you know, you're not going to import frozen fish from England. You're not.
No.
You know, you're on a little atoll surrounded by water, surrounded by fish, and first thing you're going to do is go fishing and go out with the fishermen, catch the fish, and then try and adapt those recipes. Adapt those ingredients to your recipes. And then bring in different things that you've seen and learned and eaten along the way, you know. So I like to be fresh food, really.
Yes, it sounds absolutely glorious. John, I've been wondering this for a while. I wonder if you can help me out with it, because for me there is, but I'm simply a layman looking out. Is there a chef mafia? And what I mean by that, it's a sort of slightly random way of saying it, is it feels to me like head chefs become kingmakers because they then appoint future head chefs for other restaurants. Raymond Blanc, for example, was your godfather, as it were, because you worked with Le Manoir Cassaison, and he then appointed you head chef of Le Petit Blanc. And you know, there's several other examples of head chefs that have created future stars. So do you see what I mean? Is there a chef mafia?
I don't think it's a chef mafia. I think that food in England now is fabulous. And it's fabulous because we've had a couple of generations of maybe a dozen fabulous chefs from all parts of the world. And they spun this offspring that are as good, if not better. And I don't think it's a mafia. I just think that it's like anything else. If you work for a top professional and learn of a top professional, that's going to influence your ability and capability. So, and I think, and then you go forth and do your own thing, and then you might spawn another person or two or three chefs. And I think that's what happened. I think the ones that did the most for us, as I'm talking about England, or the British Isles, were the Roux brothers, I think, because they came as brothers from France. One was particularly good at pastry, the other one particularly good at sauce cookery. And they started their restaurant. I think the first one was the Gavroche. And they had young chefs working for them that would have gone on to be as much or bigger or better or as good. So, and I think that's, you know, if you want to learn how to do anything, if you particularly enjoy working with wood, for example, you go and get yourself an apprenticeship with a great cabinet maker, you know, and learn his technique, learn his style, learn his appreciation, and then go off and work for someone else just as good. And that's what's happened. I don't know if mafia is the right word. Mm. Sometimes you find the guys that say they're self-taught. I have to look, I'm very cynical about that, and I always look deeply, and I think, okay, you know, self-taught, really. And then you find out that they've worked in a fabulous place in France.
Right.
So I can't think of anyone getting up in the morning and saying, oh, I'm going to be a fabulous chef, and I don't know what I'm talking about, because you do have to learn the basics and the foundation of this job, you know?
Yes, absolutely. No, that makes complete sense. John, can we talk about TV and media? Because, of course, you've done so much, and it will have played a big impact in your career. In 2000, you decided to have a bit of downtime. You moved to France for a reboot, as it were. But that didn't really leave you alone, did it? That turned into a Channel 4 show called French Leave, which sort of kicks
off. You know, I absolutely loved doing that. And that was in a previous life. And I don't like living with any regrets, but that was probably my biggest regret, that I didn't actually buy the place that I was living in, because that was offered to me before I left after doing the series. But I absolutely, absolutely 100% love France. And there are so many other television ideas that I've got in my head, which I'd love to do in France. Because there's things that I've seen. I mean, I love the fact that you go from region to region in France, and every region's got one or two or three or more specialities. And then I love finding out why have they got those, and why do they grow there, and why are they reared there, but then 60 miles down the road they don't, you know. And I love all that. I love the history of food. And I've always thought that I'd love to do a program where I would be in France finding out about the specialities, and then a French chef would be in England finding out about their British ones, and we'd have to cook similar dishes. So, like, you'd have bread and butter pudding in England. Where did that come from? How was it first made? Who ever thought about that? And then of course, it's all about stale bread and what you do with it. But then in France, they've got exactly the same thing, but not in the same presentation and not prepared in the same way. Like, they call it pain perdu, where you have the old brioche and it's soaked in the custard and it's cooked. And it's served with apples and calvados and blah, 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 blah. And we have our bread and butter pudding. And there's so many things like that. Black pudding in England and black pudding in France, so similar but so different. And I just love... I just love how there's different styles of food in France, you know, as you move down. And where did those influences come from? You know, who were the first to get tomatoes? And why are tomatoes all over Italy when they came from the Middle East? So I don't know. I'm just inspired by that. And I think French Leave was a real eye-opener for me because it was more about the people and the ingredients than anything else. I think I picked probably the worst place in France for creative cooking. You know, there was duck and duck everywhere, and there was not much else in the southwest. But then if you moved a little bit left or a little bit right or a little bit north or south, there was new ingredients, and that sort of inspired me to, and new people and different people and passionate people about what they grew. And I loved it. I was absolutely consumed with it. And I just think, oh, God. I think I thought, I was trying to be sensible, and I was thinking, I could buy this farmhouse in the southwest with all these people I've met who I love, they love me. And I'd live there happily ever after. But of course, you've got to earn a living, haven't you? So I chickened out and I said, all right, I'll go back home and open a restaurant.
Yes, that's the rub. I'll go back to what I know and do best. But living behind this wonderful experience. But you could always go back though, John. And that really was...
I'd love to.
Well, I mean, it's there, isn't it? You could absolutely do it. But that was the start of your... I mean, you've been on the telly as an ever-present really ever since in different guises, haven't you?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I did a very commercial show once, and that got me noticed by where I wasn't noticed. Probably I was known in the catering industry, but I wasn't really noticed. You know, I wasn't a face that I could walk down the street and nobody knew who I was. And then I did a very commercial show, and then that span off a load of television jobs. And actually, I haven't done any television for a long time, but it's something I'd like to do again, because the bottom line is I'm show off. So and there's nothing better than showing off on television. You know, it's good or bad, it's still the best. Radio and television, the media, just has always been so fabulous, really.
So the dream. So the dream for you, John, is cooking amazing food on TV in France.
No, that would totally be my ultimate thing. Yeah, definitely. And there's so many things. I mean, I'd like to do a program on, you know, the wines of Burgundy and the history of champagne. And it's really amazing how champagne has become such a commercial thing. And, you know, it used to be so elitist and so expensive. And now, you know, 18-year-olds celebrate their in England, celebrate their birthday with a bottle of champagne, you know. And it's really interesting because the more I looked into it, I mean, there was a story, I think it was Mum Champagne, where the connections with Germany and the German family in Mum, and they probably, if you're French, you will never admit this. But I loved the story when I was in the vineyard there and in the cave. They told me about this chap bursting through the gates during World War II in his Panzer tank and driving right up to the chateau, jumping out of the tank, reaching into his pocket, pulling out a key and unlocking the front door. You know, and I just thought, oh my God, you know, that's a brilliant story. And and then the more you look into it and the three great varieties in the bottle of champagne and why this flavour, why this soil, and then the cooking from, you know, champagne sauce for fish and champagne in desserts. And it can go on and on and on and on and on. And the difficulty is to get the excitement of the ingredients and the places and the job and the food over into television without looking totally mad, you know, because you get so excited and carried away with yourself, you look like that loony boffin, you know, who's talking nonsense. But I just love it, you know, I just love cooking.
Brilliant. John, it's so wonderful talking to you. Your passion is so apparent, and I sincerely hope you do make these French TV shows because they sound fantastically watchable.
No, I'd love to. Maybe when all this nonsense calmed down, some production company might approach me. And I mean, I'm still interested in opening a little restaurant too, you know, because you know, when I came back from Vietnam, it was at the end of January, not this year, last year, because the Far East got COVID sort of 2 months prior to,
yes,
I think, what were we, 23rd of March? So, yeah, so 2 months before, I was flying back from Vietnam and thinking, oh, God, what now, what's going to happen? And when I was sitting here on the first lockdown, my son and I decided to work together and start growing stuff in our old an old piece of garden that we cleared, and we did a little cookbook which we put out in 6 months, just over the spring and summer season last year, and I put it out on Amazon.
Yes,
but then I looked at the book when it's finished and it's out, and I'm thinking, but you know, what about autumn and what about winter and why haven't I put that recipe in? And even now today, we're thinking about what we can plant and what we can grow and what, you know, because everyone has their likes and dislikes. And I knew that last year, in a panic, I planted everything I possibly could. And then I realised, you know, why not plant spring onions when you can buy them for 20p a bunch? You know, you want to plant what you like or what's expensive or what's different to grow. But I got into foraging, you know, for blackberries when they come up in August. And I made blackberry jelly and we sold it at the top of the hill, at the top of our driveway, because I live on a little farm. And slow gin, I made slow gin and wild garlic, which is everywhere. And, you know, I made things. Mushrooms, we picked mushrooms and then went fishing for mackerel and sea bass. And I just think, you know, there's nothing like getting free food, is there?
No.
You know, actually finding ingredients and then coming home and making something that didn't cost you anything. I just think that's great.
Yeah, absolute treat.
Well, I'm waffling now.
No, no, John, it's great. I bet lockdown was fun with you. I mean, I'm just thinking to myself, wow.
It was brilliant. Like everything else, a bit mad. But I'm going to make it my business to find a publisher and take my old homegrown and by father and son and redo it, put in all the recipes I want to do it and in a different presentation and give people much more of an idea. But, you know, when you do things in a hurry, you sometimes miss out on things.
Yes.
And much more of an idea how to grow the stuff, you know, and this, an approach to cooking of it.
Fantastic. Yeah. I look forward
to that.
Brilliant. John, thank you. I look forward to seeing that book because it sounds terrific. You know, the revised, and I love your idea of tactical small holding, you know, go for the stuff that's expensive in the shops. Perfect. Love that. But most important, it's been a real treat having this time with you because your passion, enthusiasm, knowledge and insight is just, it's world class. Thank you so much for your company. It's been brilliant.
No, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you very much. And sorry, I was waffling quite a lot.
No, it's none at all. I've absolutely loved it. So I really, really appreciate it. Thank you.
If you're enjoying the Andy J podcast, we'd love a review. In fact, if you're enjoying the show, why not tell your friends? Podcasts live and die on, well, often word of mouth, so please tell your friends. Like, subscribe, review, and share. Thank you.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.